Good morning. I'm Mark Smith. Joining me this morning by phone, U.S. Senator Mark Pryor. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. Thank you for having me again.
Good to have you with us. It is a cold morning here in Arkansas. I don't know how it is in Washington, but
well, it's cold up here too. It's like 20 degrees and snowing. It looks like the snow is just clearing up. So yeah, we're kind of feeling your pain there.
I'd like to get snow here. It looks like we may get freezing rain tonight, though.
No, it's always trouble.
Well, I know the inauguration was the big event in Washington this week. There's been a lot of analysis about the president's second inaugural address and the vision that he laid out, the direction he wants to take in his second term. What were your thoughts on this?
Well, I think overall, I think, you know, these presidential inaugurations, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance, but one of the things I like about them is it's a kind of an unshakable American tradition of a peaceful transfer of power. And I remember a few years ago when President Bush was being sworn in for a second time, you know, John Kerry was probably 20 feet from him there on the platform, and he had just defeated John Kerry. And, you know, obviously, Senator McCain is there and all these other people who've been running over the years. And so it's a great peaceful transfer of power. You know, I thought the president's address, you know, he laid out some of the things he wanted to do in the new Congress. I think we'll just have to wait and see. Probably from the State of the Union we'll hear more, and then when you get his budget, that's also when you see some priorities, because you know that's kind of when you're putting your money where your mouth is. So we'll see how it plays out.
Is the atmosphere in Washington and particularly in Congress different now since the election and since the New Year's fiscal cliffhanger?
You know, it is a little different. It's different in probably a couple ways. One is the fiscal cliff is behind us, and that was building a lot of tension. But also, I mean, it was a very openly discussed thing the last couple of years that the Republicans' number one priority was to make sure Barack Obama did not win his reelection. And, you know, that's behind us now. And I'm hoping that now we can actually kind of focus on governing. And, in fact, one of the problems we've had in the Senate is we've had just filibuster after filibuster, and there have been wrongs committed by both sides. I'm not just blaming the Republicans, because Democrats have been guilty of a lot of things, too. And I've been working with a bipartisan group led by Senator Levin and Senator McCain to try to come up with a set of rules changes that will, you know, part of it includes kind of our version of the talking filibuster, but that will make the Senate a better place. And I think that Senator Reid and Senator McConnell, the majority-minority leaders, I think they are very close to saying yes to our package, if not every single word of it. Our package is modified by them. And if that's the case, I feel better about 2013 than I did about 2011 and 2012.
And, you know, we mentioned the fiscal cliff New Year's Eve drama there. There was this after-the-last-minute agreement on revenues. Are spending cuts now going to be seriously addressed, do you think?
They are, and, you know, we've already done some spending cuts. Back in the days when we had things like Graham Rudman and some of those budget hawk-type proposals back in the 80s and 90s, we put the Congress, they put hard spending caps on the federal government. And we've already done that. In 2011, we did the Budget Control Act. And again, this hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, but we're cutting $110 billion of discretionary spending out of this fiscal year. At least that's the plan. We still have to do it, but that's the plan. And then you have other cuts in the future years. It's going to be a total of something like $1.2 trillion in cuts over time. So we are already cutting our discretionary spending. We're going to have to do some more cuts. I know that. But also, I'm hoping that we will do tax reform and entitlement reform. I would love to say we could get tax reform done this year. I think we have a chance of doing that. And I hope we lay the groundwork for doing real entitlement reform this year and, you know, do that over the next 2 or 3 years.
You mentioned waiting to see the president's budget. How do you feel about this no budget, no pay legislation that's being proposed?
You know, I have mixed feelings about it. I totally understand why people are supportive of it. It's simple. It sounds good. It's kind of almost kind of punitive to Congress for not doing their job. I'm more frustrated than anybody on Congress not doing its job, but I have a major constitutional concern with it. You know, Amendment 27 says you cannot vary congressional pay until after the next election. So I don't even know if it's constitutional. I know the House passed it. we're looking at it. We're going to look very closely at the House language and see if it's constitutional. I think the bottom line is people all over the country want us to get a budget, want us to take care of our business. And here again, if we get some of these rules changes in the Senate, these are very modest rules changes, but they really create a pathway for us to be more productive and allow us to get on legislation. And just for your listeners to know, right now, under the Senate rules, when you want to, when you go to a bill, of course, it can be filibustered. But there's also, if the other side won't agree to you even going to the bill, you can filibuster the motion to proceed. So you really can get a double filibuster. And then when it comes time for doing something like appointing conferees, where you know the House passes a bill, the Senate passes a bill, then you appoint conferees to go to conference and work it out. There's three filibusters on conferees, and it's just the archaic nature of the Senate rules. So we're trying to clean that up and streamline that, and hopefully we can get things moving again here in the Senate.
Can you talk about entitlement reform? What do you think? What are we talking about there? Where do you think the spending cuts need to be made and are going to be made?
Well, we have to remember that about two-thirds of all federal spending is entitlement spending. And so people talk about, you know, the waste, fraud, and abuse or whatever, the inefficiency of government. But that most of what they're talking about there is only about a third of the spending that we do. The two-thirds is entitlement spending. So the big entitlement programs are Medicare and Social Security. But there's, I don't know, 15 or 20 other entitlement programs, you know, things like the school lunch program and all kinds of things. They are entitlements. We're going to have to get inside of all those programs. Some of those programs, like Medicare, first and foremost, is just not sustainable. Social Security is in better shape, but it's not sustainable over the next, you know, like three decades or so. So we need to fix that. And then we're going to have to get into all these entitlement reforms and make sure that they are sustainable. And, you know, you take something like Medicare. Listen, Medicare has been a phenomenally successful program for this country. And there is a reason why Medicare is there, and there's a reason why it works. And one of the reasons it's there is because private insurance companies don't want to insure seniors. They just don't. It's more costly to insure seniors. They have more health needs than young people, you know, and all this. So that's how Medicare works. It's been amazingly successful on extending people's lives, improving the quality of their lives. Huge, huge economic positive for the whole country. And so we need to reform it and make it sustainable.
Well, one thing we heard just a little while ago on NPR, they were talking about the National Flood Insurance Program, which is another area where the private insurance companies did not want to provide flood insurance because it wasn't a moneymaker and they didn't have the proper data and so on. And so the government got into that, and now there are serious concerns about the viability of that program.
Well, the flood insurance program, we did a national flood insurance reform this last year. I hope we did enough. You know, I stepped in because basically one of the solutions coming out of the Senate, which I did not agree with, was that if you live near a dam or some other levee or some other flood control structure, then you had to buy flood insurance. Well, that doesn't make sense because by virtue of you being behind a levee or a dam, that may mean you're never going to flood. And so we try to put a dose of common sense in this, but the truth is that the flood insurance program has been in trouble for a long time. It's been bleeding money, especially after Katrina, and
right.
I'm sure the NPR story covered
yes.
that. But,
yeah.
you know, especially after Katrina, but there were other major events, and it just hasn't been funded adequately. And, you know, we definitely need to do better on that. There's no doubt about it because it's a program that can work and should work, and it's important. But it's running out of money all the time now. It's running in the red.
Well, also causing concern for many people are new gun laws. The president has proposed restoring the ban on so-called assault weapons and limits on high-capacity magazines, universal background checks, these kind of things. Are any of these, do you consider them to be drastic or unreasonable measures?
Well, maybe. I don't know exactly what is going to be proposed in the Senate. I'm looking forward to seeing what various senators want to offer. Listen, I completely understand how emotional the Connecticut shooting was. I mean, it was a terrible thing. We wish it never would have happened, shouldn't have happened. But, you know, the question is, how do we prevent that type of thing from happening again in the future? And I'm a strong supporter of Second Amendment rights. I think most people in Arkansas are. But as we go through this conversation, you know, I'd say first we ought to enforce the laws we have on the books, because we do have some law in there that's probably not being enforced enough. But secondly, I'd say we need to look for areas of common ground. And when we are having this discussion, certainly I want to talk to school officials, want to talk to parents, also want to talk to law enforcement. You know, we talk about our men and women in uniform, and we're so proud of all of our veterans and all that, but we have other people in uniform too, and those are people that are police officers and state troopers and deputy sheriffs all over the state of Arkansas. They put their lives online every day for us too. So we need, if they deserve a seat at the table here, and you know, I'll listen to them. And also the whole mental health issue, and that's something that, you know, quite honestly, I've been frustrated about, because I've been a supporter of mental health parity and trying to get more mental health services, not just in Arkansas, but around the nation. And, you know, that's been tough in the budget wars, and also, you know, the COPS program to put more police officers on the streets. And that means also more police officers in schools. You know, we've seen that program reduce quite a bit, especially during the Bush years. So, look, I look forward to the conversation. I look forward to listening to people. But I do think, one last thing, I don't want to talk too long on this, but I do think that we have a rare opportunity here, because we had the assault weapons ban on the books for about 10 years. We can look at the statistics before, then we can look at the stats during, and then after the assault weapons ban, and we ought to be able to measure to see if it was effective. And, you know, there was a study that the Department of Justice did back in 2004, and I'm not trying to overgeneralize, but basically they said that the assault weapons ban had little effect on violent crime in America, and it wasn't no effect, but it was very small, almost hard to measure effect. So, you know, let's talk about all that.
Well, one thing that I don't see actually being proposed, the president hasn't proposed it, and Congress certainly would not support it, is any proposal that would involve the confiscation of personal firearms. So why is there such a fear that that's what's coming?
Yeah, I don't think you're ever going to see that. I think you're right. I think that, you know, what some of the national groups say is they're going to take your guns away. That's not going to happen. Nobody's talking about taking guns away. What they're talking about is, as you move forward, and maybe if you buy an assault weapon, or maybe you buy any gun with background checks, or maybe there's certain ammo that's not available, or certain size clips that aren't available, but that's all if you move forward. I don't think there's anything that's being proposed or even talked about to actually talk about confiscating what people have right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this Keystone XL pipeline. It was postponed due to concerns about the route that it was taking. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, I heard a click there and wasn't sure if I'd lost you. But there was concern about the route that it was taking, particularly through Nebraska, I believe. That plan, I believe, has been rerouted now, and you're one of a group of senators pushing for approval of the pipeline.
Yeah, I've been pushing for this for a long time. I think it's in our national security interest, and also our national interest in terms of our economy and our energy future and all that. I think we ought to do this. You know, there was a ton of rhetoric on this maybe 6 months or a year ago about, would the president approve it and all this kind of jazz. The truth of the matter is we've really been waiting on Nebraska. The pipeline is going to go right through Nebraska, and the legislature and the governor and other people there were not comfortable with the sites that it was going through. So, you know, they wanted to do a study. They wanted to make sure it wasn't going to harm aquifers, make sure it wasn't going to harm the environment, you know, all these things. And we understand that. We'd want to do the same thing in Arkansas if it was coming through our state. So they finally finished that. So now that is behind us. Now the ball is finally in the president's court. And I'm hoping and I'm urging with 50-plus of my colleagues that the president will sign off on the pipeline, that he'll clear the way and give it the green light. I think it's going to provide significant economic benefits to the U.S. and to Arkansas. Of course, we make most of the pipeline in Arkansas at Wellspun and Little Rock. But also it will decrease our dependency on Mideast oil, which is a good thing, and also it will really help us long-term for our energy security, because we won't be relying on tankers coming out of the Mideast, and we all know how dicey that can be. And, you know, the amazing thing about this, and this is an important point, I think, for everybody to think about, the amazing thing about this is for decades, politicians have said, well, we want energy independence. Well, we actually can now look out and see over the next few years, the U.S. could literally be energy independent, especially if you count this pipeline as domestic, which is technically not because it's Canada, but it's near domestic for us. If you count that, I mean, you can really see how we're going to be energy independent within the next few years, and that is a very good place to be, and we need to continue moving toward that.
Well, just very quickly, still a lot of people have concerns about this. Are you concerned at all about the environmental impact of doing things like they're doing, gleaning oil from the tar sands in Canada?
You know, I'm not. I mean, I know that Canada has pretty strict environmental regulations up there, and I'm assuming that they're taking care of it on their end, and then it'll come down hopefully into U.S. refineries. We'll refine it just like, you know, we do everything else, and we'll meet all U.S. safety standards and environmental standards, so I feel good about that. And also, we've been building pipelines in this country for over 100 years, and they're extremely safe. So I just don't see the big environmental concern. You know, if someone has a legit concern, let's talk about it and let's work through it. But I just don't see that. And I think we're a lot better off refining it and burning it in U.S. engines than we are sending it to China, because that's what Canada will do. They're going to find a market for it. It's either coming to the U.S. or it's going to go to China. So one or the other, and I think we're a lot better off seeing it happen in the U.S. rather than in China.
All right. U.S. Senator Mark Pryor, we're out of time. Thank you for your time today.
Hey, thank you. Anytime.
U.S. Senator Mark Pryor joining us from his office in Washington. You're listening to Morning Edition on KASU Jonesboro.